The following presentation was recorded at the Christian Worldview Workshop at Faith Builders. More information on Faith Builders events at fbep.org.
Ideas have consequences, including the ideas that have shaped you and me. The ideas that have shaped our century. We're in the last year of this century. So perhaps it's appropriate if we take a few moments and reflect a bit. As modern man moved into the 1900s, we brought with us a hope and an optimism. A hope and an optimism that man was getting better. That we were beginning to perfect our world. You see, it had been 30 years. Since we'd had, the significant nations had had a major conflict. So perhaps, we had finally figured out how to put war behind us. Darwin's evolutionary theory gave us reason for optimism and hope. Man was getting better. Oh, and science. The incredible things that science was giving to us. The explosion in technology. The advent of electricity in the airplane, the vehicle. There was nothing that we couldn't do with the application of our reason and with science. And that optimism lasted for another 14 years. With the advent of World War I, optimism begins to decline. World War I, 10 million deaths. In fact, during that war, the battle line only moved around 10 miles in a course of 3 to 4 years. And those 10 million lives, most of them were lost on that battle line moving. Just a short distance. One half of the French men from ages 20 to 32 lost their lives. A half of a generation gone. The slogan before World War I was every day and in every way, man is getting better and better. And World War I began to challenge that. And following in rapid succession, we have the rise of communism, the Russian Revolution, and the spread of communism across the East. We have the economic depression of the 30s. We have the purges of Stalin, where millions were killed. All of these things came as hammer blows against this optimism, this hope we had in the goodness of man and his ability to reason and to solve his problems. And then comes World War II and the Holocaust. I would like to just share one eyewitness account of what happened at one of the thousands of killings of Jews and other people. It says, I heard rifle shots. In quick succession from behind one of the earth mounds, the people who got off the trucks, men and women and children of all ages, had to undress upon the orders of all the SS men who carried a riding or dog whip. They had to put down their clothes in fixed places, sorted according to shoes, top clothing and underclothing. I saw a heap of shoes of about 800 to 1,000 pairs, great piles of underlinen and clothing. Without screaming or weeping, these people undressed, stood around in family groups, kissed each other, said farewells, and waited for a sign from another SS man who stood near the pit. During the 15 minutes that I stood near, I heard no complaints or pleas for mercy. I watched a family of about 8 persons, a man and a woman, both about 50, with their children aged about 1, 8, and 10, and 2 grown-up daughters, about 20 to 24. An old woman with snow-white hair was holding the one-year-old child in her arms and singing to it and tickling it. The child was cooing with delight. The couple was looking on with tears in their eyes. The father was holding the boy about 10 years old, and the hand of the boy about 10 years old, and speaking to him softly. The boy was fighting his tears. The father pointed to the sky and stroked his head, seemed to explain something to him. That moment, the man at the pit shouted something to his comrade. The man counted about 20 persons and instructed them to go behind the earth mound. I walked around the mound and found myself confronted by a tremendous grave. People in it were closely wedged together and lying on top of each other so that only their heads were visible. Nearly all had blood running from the shoulders, from their heads, and some of the people shot were still moving. Some were lifting their arms and turning their heads to show that they were still alive. The pit was already two-thirds full. I estimated that it already contained about 1,000 people. I looked for the man who did the shooting. It was an aged man who sat at the edge of the narrow end of the pit, his feet dangling into the pit. He had a Tommy gun on his knees and was smoking a cigarette. The people, completely naked, went down the steps, which were cut in the clay wall of the pit, clambered over the heads of the people laying there to the place to which the man directed them. They laid down in front of the dead or injured people. Some caressed those who were still alive and spoke to them in a low voice. Then I heard a series of shots. What are the ideas that produce such incredible evil? You smug-faced crowds with kindling eye, who cheer while soldier lads pass by, sneak home and pray. You'll never know the hell where youth and laughter go. And World War II comes to an end with the bombing of Hiroshima. On August 6th, there wasn't a cloud in the sky above Hiroshima, and a mild, hardly perceptible wind blew from the south. Visibility was almost perfect for 10 or 12 miles. At 7:09 in the morning, an air raid warning sounded and four American B-29 planes appeared. To the north of the town, two of them turned and made off to the south and disappeared in the direction of the Shoho Sea. The other two, after having circled the neighborhood of Shukai, flew off at high speed southwards in the direction of the Bingo Sea. At 7:31, the all-clear was given. Feeling themselves in safety, people came out of their shelters and went about their affairs. The work of the day began. Suddenly, a glaring whitish-pinkish light appeared in the sky, accompanied by an unnatural tremor, which was followed almost immediately by a wave of suffocating heat and a wind which swept away everything in its path. Within a few seconds, the thousands of people in the streets and the gardens in the center of the town were scorched by a wave of searing heat. Many were killed instantly. Others lay writhing on the ground, screaming in agony from the intolerable pain of their burns. Everything standing upright in the way of the blast, walls, houses, factories, buildings, was annihilated. The debris spun around in a whirlwind and carried up into the air. Trams were picked up and tossed aside as though they had neither weight nor solidity. Trains were flung off the rails as though they were toys. Horses, dogs, cattle suffered the same fate as human beings. Every living thing was petrified in an attitude of indescribable suffering. Even the vegetation did not escape. Trees went up in flames. The rice plants lost their greenness. The grass burned on the ground like dry straw. Beyond the zone of utter death in which nothing remained alive, houses collapsed in a whirl of beams, bricks, and girders. Up to about 3 miles from the center of the explosion, lightly built houses were flattened as though they'd been built of cardboard. Those who were inside were either killed or wounded. Those who managed to extricate themselves by some miracle found themselves surrounded by a ring of fire. And the few who succeeded in making their way to safety generally died 20 or 30 days later from the delayed effects of the deadly gamma rays. Some of the reinforced concrete or stone buildings remained standing, but their interiors were completely gutted by the blast. About half an hour after the explosion, while the sky all around Hiroshima was still cloudless, a fine rain began to fall in the town. It went on for about 5 minutes. It was caused by the sudden rise of overheated air to a great height, where it condensed and fell back as rain. Then a violent wind rose and the fires extended with terrible rapidity, because most Japanese houses are built only of timber and straw. By the evening, the fire began to die down, and then it went out. There was nothing left to burn. Hiroshima had ceased to exist. And with it, around 100,000 people died. A town the size of Erie, Pennsylvania, completely wiped out. Another 100,000 wounded. What are the ideas? What are the ideas that produce this kind of tragedy? The ideas and beliefs that brought us into the 1900s have played themselves out in this past century. Now, as we move in to the 2000s, we've inherited a different set of ideas. Ideas that are going to shape our century, just like this past century was shaped. And our purpose here today is to think about the ideas that are shaping our lives. Think about the beliefs that we have, the beliefs that we should have. Here this morning in this first session, what I want to do is spend a little time introducing the idea of a worldview, what all is involved in that. And so we'll do a worldview overview. And then I want to look at two issues that are absolutely key, foundational to a worldview. And those two issues are reality and truth. Reality, what is really real? What is significant? What is worth spending your time on? What's important? The issue of truth. Does truth exist? How do we know it? Can we know it? So this is the agenda for this morning. Now, I have quite a bit of material that I need to move through. However, I may not get it completed, and I guess I'll be okay with that. But that's just a little bit of a warning, perhaps. If you have never heard some of the ideas discussed that we'll be talking about this weekend, this may feel a little overwhelming. It may feel like it's hard to really connect with it. And, you know, I was talking with a friend, a good friend of mine last evening about some of these ideas we're going to be talking about. And he said, you know, I have studied this. I have thought about this stuff for quite a few years now. But he says, it's just starting to come together and really make sense for me. And so if you're at the beginning of that cycle, it's okay. Hang in there. Don't let maybe some of the terminology or some of the people, don't let that derail you from hanging in there with us and thinking about the issues that we're going to be talking about. A worldview overview. What is a worldview? I'm going to suggest that very simply, it is a set of beliefs, ideas, by which we live and which we die. It's two things here. First of all, it's a model by which we understand the world. It's this grid or model by which we're able to take the different things that are happening in the world and fit it into this model and make sense out of it. So it's a model by which we understand the world. It's also a guide for living, to help us live within the world, a model to understanding the world, and a guide to help us live in the world. I'd like to compare our worldview to two things. First of all, our worldview is like a pair of glasses. Our glasses, those of you who wear them know, that they shape everything that we see. Everything that's out there, they give shape to it. Our worldviews do the same thing. All of the things that we hear, see, experience are filtered through our worldviews and give it shape. Our worldviews are also like glasses in the sense that, you know, a pair of glasses, if the doctor has done his job well, my glasses will help me to see reality the way it really is. A good prescription will help me to see things the way things really are. A poor prescription, if the doctor doesn't do his job well and distorts the lenses, I won't see things the way they really are. And it's the same way with our worldviews. If our worldview is distorted, the input, our experiences, the things we hear, the things we read, the things we think about will be distorted because it's all shaped and seen through our worldview. You know, our glasses, we're often unaware of them being there. Oh, at the beginning, yeah, you think about it a bit. But after that, they're just there. They're transparent. You don't think about them. It's the same way with our worldview. It's often just there. It's there in function, but we're not necessarily conscious of it. We're not reflective about what that worldview is doing to us. Some years ago, I remember sitting in church. I was toward the back. It was a nice-sized auditorium, about the size of this, maybe a little larger. And I was toward the back, and during the sermon, I looked up to see what time it was, and I realized that, you know, I'm not even sure if I can tell what time it is. I couldn't quite make it out. And I looked over at the minister, and the thought occurred to me that if I didn't know who was standing up there, I wouldn't be able to recognize him. I was getting a distorted view of reality. I had to go and have some corrective lenses brought into my experience. Fallen humanity has bad eyesight. Our natural worldview gives us distorted vision. It's important that we work on and are reflective about that worldview so that we can see reality for what it is. Another simile for a worldview is that a worldview is like a map. This summer we took a trip to, our family took a trip to Colorado. And a month or so before then, we put a big map of the United States up on the wall so that we could all kind of see the parameters of the United States and see where Pennsylvania was in that and where Colorado is. We wanted to get that big picture. It's what a worldview does for us. Gives us the overview. What's the territory like? Gives us the challenges of the journey that we have before us. It's also like a map in that it not only gives us that big picture, but it gives us a guide for how to get to our destination. Not only did we put that map on the wall, but we kind of circled Meadville, and we circled Canyon City, Colorado. And we traced the route that we were planning to take out there. The map served as a guide for our journey. Our world views can serve as a guide for our journey here in this life. George Barna said that without a biblical worldview, all the great teaching goes in one ear and out the other. There are no intellectual pegs in the mind of the individual to hang these truths on, so they just pass through. They don't stick. They don't make a difference. I've included in your handout some other definitions for what a worldview is. And I think I'll pass over those for now. Why is being intentional about our worldview significant? We've talked a little bit about what it is. Why should we care about our worldview? Why should we take off our glasses and examine them a bit this weekend? Why should we do that not just this weekend, but every day and all of life? Why should we check and see if they're maybe dirty? Maybe if there's a problem with them. Maybe they're not giving us a clear view of reality. Why should we do that? I'm going to suggest, first of all, that an incorrect worldview can be very dangerous and even life-threatening. We're talking here about a matter of life and death. Our worldviews and being intentional about our worldviews are significant from that end. We need to be intentional about them because if we're not, We're condemned to absorb the worldview of the culture around us. We're going to have a worldview. The question is, which one, and is it going to be the truth? And if we're not going to be intentional about it, we're condemned to the worldview of the dominant culture around us. Colossians 2:8 tells us, it says, "See to it that no one takes you captive through philosophy and empty deception, according to the tradition of men, according to the elementary principles of the world, rather than according to Christ." There are philosophies, there are worldviews that are out to take us captive. This is war. This is war. And there are worldviews that want us POWs on the side of error and evil. I'm going to also suggest it's important that we're intentional about our worldview development, because it's only as we have an adequate worldview that our lives are going to be relevant and are going to be productive and actually have a significant role in ministry in this life. What then are the characteristics of an adequate worldview? What this worldview that we're trying to develop, each of us are working toward, what are the characteristics of one that's adequate, that's good, that's true? Give a couple characteristics here. First of all, it should be consistent with observation and experience. Our worldview should not go against what we actually observe and experience in life. There should be sufficient evidence to support an adequate worldview. I remember talking with a brother in church one time, and he said, "You know, there's just some of these issues, some of these questions about the way we do things and so on." He said, "There's no way that you can think through all this stuff and come out at good places." He said, "Some of it you just have to take by faith." I don't agree. An adequate worldview is consistent with observation and experience. We can think through it and it fit the world that we're living in. Secondly, it should not require belief in contradictory things or cause us to ignore information that seems incompatible. Thirdly, an adequate worldview should explain reality in ways that are intellectually and emotionally satisfying and compelling. Our worldview should not be something that we just have to adopt in order to keep peace in the family. It shouldn't be something that we have to turn our minds off in order to hold it. It should be intellectually and emotionally satisfying and compelling. It should draw us. There should be this, ah, yes, factor to it. Fourth, an adequate worldview should speak to all areas of reality. It should be comprehensive and provide adequate answers to the questions in each area. Are you questioning a lot of things? An adequate worldview will not ask you to stop. It will ask you to keep coming to belief, but it won't ask you to stop asking the questions. And fifth, an adequate worldview should provide a unifying passion and purpose for living. A unifying passion and purpose for living. It should call us to a vision that's bigger than what we are. And it shouldn't be necessary to borrow from other worldviews in order to live and survive. Well, what are the categories? What are the big questions that we need to deal with? What are the concepts, the ideas that we have to think of to flesh out this worldview? A worldview, there's many, many aspects of it, but there are three major categories that we want to think about this weekend. They are the categories of philosophy, theology, and anthropology. Philosophy, there on the bottom, we have seven different parts of philosophy that I want to point out to you. Often we think of philosophy as the study of truth and wisdom. There are five major categories to philosophy. One is the question of beauty or aesthetics. And in this category, we ask the questions, what is really beautiful? You know, is beauty really just in the eye of the beholder? Or is there something objective there? The Greek philosophers, they thought that there were absolute standards of what was really beautiful in art, in music, and so on. You know, one person likes Southern gospel music and another likes classical. Is this just completely a matter of personal whim? Or are there standards that apply? This is the question of beauty. Another category of the five major categories of philosophy is the category, I'm going to jump to the other corner there, category of truth. Does truth exist? How can we know it? Can I really know if there's a God even if I can't see or hear or touch Him? Is the Bible really true? Is it, if it's true, is it inspired of God? We hear things like, you know, that's all right for you to believe, but that's not something I can. Or all paths lead to God. These are the questions of truth. Another category is category of reality. Category of being. What one of the Greek philosophers put it this way. He says, why is there something rather than nothing? Why is there something rather than nothing? And what is this something? You've heard the question, if a tree fell in a forest and there was no one around to hear it, does it make a sound? This is where that question comes from. Question of what is real? Third category there on the bottom is the category of good and evil or ethics. Does right and wrong exist? How do we determine? Is it ethical? Is it right in order to lie to save an innocent life? Is it right to steal from a thief? I remember seeing some graffiti in a bathroom one time. Someone had written on there, apparently a brother in the Lord, he put, open your heart to Jesus, He will come in. And I said, hey, that's kind of neat. See that there. But then someone underneath it had written, write it on your car, holy roller. Does Jesus say it's all right to vandalize now? The question of right and wrong, question of ethics. And then the fifth category here of philosophy is a question of reason, of right thinking. What's valid and not valid when we think? What will we accept as making good sense? I remember teaching in summer Bible school one summer, and we were talking about non-resistance and going to war. We're talking about how the Mennonites believe that God doesn't want us to participate in war, and that Baptists, on the other hand, believe that God holds us responsible to defend our country. And someone from the back said, raise your hand. They said, well, is it possible that we're both right? Now, they were asking a question of reason, a question of logic. Ran across this poem recently, why are fire engines red? They have four wheels and eight men. 4 + 8 = 12. 12 inches makes a ruler. A ruler is Queen Elizabeth. Queen Elizabeth sails the seven seas. The seven seas have fish. The fish have fins. The fins hate the Russians. The Russians are red. Fire engines are always Russian. So they're red. Question of what's valid and what's not valid when we're trying to discuss and think through issues. Well, there are a number of other categories here in the area of philosophy that don't rate in the top five but are very significant. One is that of origins. Where do we come from? When did the universe begin? The universe began 15 billion years ago in a big bang, or did it appear out of nothing around 6,000 years ago? Question of origins. And then the other one that I mentioned here is the question of purpose and meaning. What purpose does the universe exist? Why do we exist? Why do you exist? Theology is another major category that defines our worldview. This is the category of God. Who is God? Is there a God? And if He is, what is He like? What is His nature? What is His character? Now, don't get the idea that this middle section here is the category for the Scriptures. It's not. The Scriptures speak into all areas of a worldview. It's not just limited to the question of God. And then in the area of anthropology, or the study of man, four more categories. Culture. What is it that makes a culture good or evil? What role does a culture play in the formation of man? Question of man. His origin, his destiny, his nature. Who is he? We don't wrestle with the same question we sometimes do in the category of God, where we ask, who is God? We generally accept the fact that we are. And once we get past that, though, what is he like? Does he have a soul? Or is he just a series of complex chemical reactions? In the words of one chemist, he said, he said 400 years ago lived a collection of molecules named Shakespeare, which produced Hamlet. Is this our view of man? Sin and salvation. How do we experience God? What is the solution to the problems in our world? How do we overcome evil? What does it mean to love God with our heart, our soul, and mind? What happens after we die? Is there hope in the world? And the question then of history, where is history headed? Is man getting better or is he getting worse? Is there a direction to all this or is not? Is it all meaningless? Does what goes around come around? The question of history. Now, we're going to be speaking about a number of these areas, not quite all of them. This gives you an idea of who we'll be talking about. What you'll see here in my session this morning, I'm planning to deal with reality and truth, and then this afternoon we'll talk some about origins and reality and truth in the session on science. After this session, Melvin will be talking about good and evil. And this afternoon, Steve Russell will be talking about history. And after my session on science. This evening, Brandon Mollett will be talking about beauty and culture, particularly as it applies to music. And tomorrow, then, we have a session on theology, who is God, what is he like, by Milo Zer, and then a session on man by Merle Herr. So this is where we're headed. So I want to talk about two things. I want to talk about reality. I want to talk about truth. What is really real?
In fact, what is? What is? Gordon Kaufman, Mennonite who teaches Harvard University, in an essay on why he's a Mennonite, talks about how that as a young person spending some time in VS, he spent time in an insane asylum. And he said most of the people there had completely lost touch with reality. He tells about a fellow there named Charlie. And he said apparently Charlie, before he wound up in the ward, had operated a little grocery store. And he said because every day when he'd go to take care of Charlie, he said Charlie would be sitting there in his chair and he'd be ringing up customers and he'd go be getting them some flour and all this kind of stuff. And he said it was very clear. He was talking you through the whole thing. He was still living in that other world. He said, as I began to help Charlie, he said, I began to wonder, is Charlie's world maybe the real world? And maybe I'm the one that's living an illusion? He said, you know, Charlie, for all he knew, he was doing what he thought he was doing. It was very, very real to Charlie. He said, I was here feeding Charlie. I was keeping him alive. And I thought my world was real, but how was I to know? How was I to know that mine was more real than his? Maybe I'm the dreamer, and Charlie, I'm a dream in Charlie's real world. He began to struggle with what's really real. Now, my suspicion is that most of us have never struggled quite on that level. But the issue is very significant for us all. Now, I'd like for us to think about, I picked up a leaf this morning. We have a leaf. What is a leaf? Well, we just named it. It's a leaf. But what's real? What's really real here? Well, I'll give you a description of what a leaf is, according to American Encyclopedia of Science. It is an outgrowth of a plant stem consisting of the lamina, petiole, and leaf base. It grows from a node. A leaf usually contains chlorophyll as a primary site of photosynthesis. Is that what this is? Milo laughs. Why do you laugh, Milo? What is a leaf? Perhaps it was a leaf, or at least some trees of leaves, that Gerard Manley Hopkins was looking at when he penned the words, "The world is charged with the grandeur of God. It will flame out like shining from shook foil. It gathers to a greatness like the ooze of oil crushed." Now, who's right? See, we could ask, if we were able to get a jar of chlorophyll and, a right number of carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen atoms and some of these petioles and some of the laminas and some other things, and we stuck them together, would we have a leaf? Is a leaf just a matter of sticking the right pieces together? Is it just the individual parts? Is that what's real? The stuff that we can actually take apart and say, here's this, here's this, and here's this, and that's what a leaf is? Or is there something substantive, something else here? What is this? It's a triangle. It's a triangle. Now, what is a triangle? Is a triangle this shape that's formed with ink on a piece of paper or a piece of film? Is that the triangle? See, if I ask you what each of these things was, you would say each of those are triangles too. But they're all different. They're different sizes. They're different, some different colors. They have different ways of doing the perimeter. And yet you all recognize them as a triangle. Why? Because you have in your mind something that has the characteristics of being triangleness, the characteristics of triangleness, that you're able to look at each of these individual things and say, oh, that's a triangle. So is the real thing this thing we see, each individual one, or is it this concept, this idea that we have in our mind that we call triangle? Which is the real thing? The thing you can touch and see and feel, or this idea, this concept? What's really real? There are two major views about what reality is. The one view, and I think I have these turned around in your notes, the first one that I want to talk about is the view that what is really real the term we're going to use is idealism. And these are some words that define the area or the realm of the ideal. You see, the person who says that what's really real, it's not those triangles that we see, it's the idea of triangle. He is an idealist. That's the realm of idealism. This is the realm of grace, a biblical term. It's the realm of the supernatural, the realm of the unseen, the realm of metaphysics, the ideals, the heavens, the universals. The Greeks use the word, the realm of the Logos. The Logos. Okay? So it's the concepts. That's what's really real. It's not those things we see on the paper. No, it's the ideas behind them. That's what's real. Well, not everyone agrees with that. Some say, no. No. It's not the ideals where you find reality. It's in the reals. It's in the things you can touch. It's in those triangles that we can see. This is the realm of nature. The realm of the seen. What I can grab a hold of. So it's natural, not supernatural. It's the natural. It's physics. Not metaphysics. It's the sarx. That's the New Testament word here. The flesh. The reals. Not the universal things. Not the triangle. But this one. It's the particulars. The things I can actually touch and feel and see and experience. It's not the heavenly. It's the stuff here on earth. That's what's real. Now, you see, I'm just wondering where you find yourself at. Is the real up here in the top? Or is the real down here in the bottom? I want to continue to flesh this idea out for a bit. And try to just bring it down to our existence on a daily basis. And to help us do that, I'd like to trace just a brief history of philosophy. But my time is getting away, and so I think I'm going to skip some of that. I would like to give you, though, two of the men that are significant in this. We have the two realms, the realms of idealism, the realms of realism. And let me also just say here a little bit more about each of these categories. If you're an idealist, If you're an idealist, you're the person who says, let me tell you, if your life's going to count, you're going to do it. You're going to work in the realm of the ideals, in the realm of the concepts. This is where we do find meaning and purpose and direction. The realm of the ideals is the realm of the, yes, I see it. But if you're a realist, you're going to put an emphasis on just being solid every day in your experience. You see, a realist, you can build with the stuff of realism. You can plan it. You can study it. You can milk it. You can get your handle on that. But the problem, there's not much meaning or purpose to the other. We'll continue to think about that a bit. Two men from history that flesh this out. The first one is Plato. Plato, Greek philosopher, believed that the really real things are the universals, the logos, the heavenly. And he fleshed this idea out in what is famously called the allegory of the cave. I want to look at this just briefly. What Plato tells us, he said, you know, man is like these people that are chained in a cave. They're chained against the wall of a cave, or against the side of the cave, and all they can do is stare at the wall. Now he said, there is a fire back here behind the chained person that's providing light. And this light throws shadows over against the cave wall. And he said, all that we see are the shadows. And he said, there are objects here in between the fire and the wall, and these are tangible, particular objects, but what they do is they throw shadows. And so all we're left with here on the earth is seeing the shadows of the real things. Now, this desk here, for example, or this podium, it's real, but what as it comes from here to my eyes, as I see it, I'm just seeing the shadow of the real thing. Okay? This is our sense perception. This would be the thing itself. But my ability to actually grasp a hold of it and perceive it right, it's more like I'm seeing a shadow rather than the thing itself. But now here's what he said. He said, outside of this cave, there's the sun. The sun is the realm of the heavenly. The concepts. He said, that's where it all is. If we could just get out of our cave, and he said there's a couple people that have managed to get unchained from the wall and walk out of the cave, and they get in the light of the sun, and that's where they get to experience the logos, the concepts, the ideas that are behind it all. He thought it was the philosophers like himself that had gotten unchained and were able to walk out of the cave. But you see, Plato said, you know what's really real? It's not these shadows of things. It's the stuff out here. That's what's really real. Not the stuff of our existence. And definitely not the perception of that stuff. It's the stuff outside. Well, his student, Aristotle, he agreed with Plato in many ways, but he rejected the idea that it was these universals that were the only reality. See, in Plato's world, the stuff of this, it really winds up being just a shadow. It's not real. The only real things is the stuff out there, and this is only real because we perceive it. Aristotle said, I disagree. This stuff is very real, and it's worth studying. We see him as the father of science. Because he said, I care about the tangible physical realities. This is real. It's important. Many years later, the artist Raphael captured these two men in what's called the School of Athens. Painting is called the School of Athens. You see here in the middle, you see Plato and Aristotle. And he paints Plato with his hand pointing up. And he paints Aristotle with his hand stretched out. Alfred North Whitehead said that all of the history of thinking winds up being just a footnote to these two guys. The ideals, the reals. Which is it? Which is the most important? Plato says that's the most important. Aristotle says this. Idealism, realism. I'm going to skip over the rest of these men and move on to talking just a little bit about the dilemma that we face by either being idealists or realists. The problem with either or. The problem with being just a realist or just an idealist. We're going to be an idealist and block off the area of the reals. This is what we will have. We will have purpose, meaning, and great ideas. Because that's the realm that our lives can get a unity. They can come together and make sense. It's up in that realm that we can connect all the little details of our life in ways that give meaning to it. Okay, so if we just have this, we have this sense of meaning, a sense of purpose, a sense of the, yeah. The problem is, it winds up being subjective, winds up being local, it winds up being unconvincing. It's what I think versus what you think. Oh, it works for me. This means something for me. This is the person, maybe, that we was described by the one who said they're so heavenly minded that they're no earthly good. Where we wind up with it just being my idea. See, we tend to do this. We tend to either move up here or move down here. If we move up here, we tend to ignore the world of the real. We tend to reject what is material. We tend to reject the body. We tend to reject the stuff of daily life. It's easy to live up here without it actually impacting our daily lives. Now, the other alternative is to ignore the realm of the ideals, to live in the world of the reals. If we take this path, we'll have objectivity and practicality. We can deal in the realm of facts and laws. This is the realm of science where there's been such a success in so many ways. The problem is that there's no meaning. There's no basis for pulling it all together. If we live here, it's like the person who spent their life accumulating a lot of possessions. You see, their emphasis is on the tangible, the real. And they wind up at 80 years old and they say, "What was it all for?" They have no unifying ideas to pull it all together for them, to give it purpose and meaning. We tend to split what is sacred up here and what is secular down here. We tend to drive a wedge between the two. There's my family, and there's my job, and there's my recreation, and then there's my quiet time and church. Two different worlds. It's easy not to see them as a whole. We drive this wedge between the ideals and the reals. Job, I think, sensed something of this dilemma when he was struggling with his situation. His situation was very real. It was very tangible. It was very much down on this level. He was struggling. And he was trying to bring some kind of meaning to that, to his experience of pain. He was trying to reach up here and bring it together, but he couldn't. And it says in Job chapter 9, verses 32, he's talking about God. He's talking about this realm up here, and he says, "He's not a man like me that I might answer him, that we might confront each other in court." Watch that. God is not a man like me. He's up here, I'm down here. He says, if only, do you hear the heart cry there? If only there was someone to arbitrate between us, to lay his hand upon us both. Someone to remove God's rod from me so that his terror would frighten me no more. This realm right here is a realm of absolute terror without this. And that's what Job's experiencing. He says, please, if there was someone who could bring these two worlds together for me. I have a world to live. I have a life to live here, and it's very tangible. It's very real. There's pain and suffering and pleasure. How am I supposed to connect that with these ideals and concepts? If only there was someone to arbitrate between us. If only. And then as we come to the New Testament, in John chapter 1, verse 14, and the Word, Logos, became flesh, sarx, and dwelt among us. In Jesus Christ, this split that we almost have to go to, either realism or idealism, comes together. Not in a statement, but in a person. The Word became flesh. The ideal became real. And dwelt among us. And we beheld His glory. The two are coming together in an incredible way. It's in Jesus Christ that these two types of reality find a complementary blending. We have both the eternal and the created come together in our worldview. You see, in Jesus, we don't have to reject the material as evil. And we don't have to only live in spiritual realms. We have a basis for redeemed interaction with the physical realities of life through Jesus Christ. All things were made, the realm of the created, by Him. All things hold together in Him. Jesus Christ pulls these two somewhat disparate realities together. Colossians 1:17, He is before all things. This existed before this. And in Him, all things hold together. We're not going to be able to get to the discussion right now on truth. And so I'm going to move into my conclusion. Modern man has accepted some ideas, a set of ideas about truth that have shaped indelibly our last century. They've accepted a split between the the ideal and the real. In fact, they've said the ideal doesn't exist, it's just the real. And what have we wound up with? We've wound up with a world of no meaning and no purpose. Someone has said that at Hiroshima, purpose or hope and optimism died. That was the death blow for it. Edward Munch was an artist that understood the purposelessness that came from this kind of a worldview. He painted this painting, The Scream. This is his most famous work, and since World War II, it has become very, very popular. And perhaps it's because the fear, the existential fear that's portrayed here in this picture captures the hopelessness of modern man. A man that has done two things, has limited himself to the realm of the reals, and secondly, has given up on truth. And that's going to only lead us to this realm of despair. Albert Camus, existential philosopher, said, "There is but only one truly serious philosophical problem, and that is suicide. Judging whether life is or is not worth living amounts to answering the fundamental questions of philosophy." Those are the ideas that shaped our generation. Edward Munch, in talking about why he painted this picture, he said this. He said, "I was walking along the road with two friends," and you can kind of make those out in the background. "The sun was setting. I felt a breath of melancholy. Suddenly the sky turned blood red. I stopped and leaned against the railing, deathly tired, looking out across the flaming clouds that hung like blood and a sword over the blue-black fjord and town. My friends walked on. I stood there, trembling with fear. And I sensed a great, infinite scream pass through nature." One of my teachers had this painting on his office wall. And when we would walk in to his office, we'd often see that, and often a first timer to his office, we'd say, "Oh, Dr. Lehman, why? Why do you have such a horrible painting on your wall?" And he said this. He said, "I keep that there to remind me what my options are." He said, "It's that or Jesus Christ." This is our world. A world that is crying for meaning, for purpose, for significance. A world that's crying for God, for Jesus Christ. Ideas have consequences. What are ours? Let's pray. Lord, we want to be people who not only think well, but live well. Lord, we want to experience your unifying presence in our lives. We want the grand truths and universals, the absolutes, to unify those parts of our lives, our jobs and our friendships, and our desires and our interests. We want all of that to take shape and meaning and purpose. And we realize that that'll happen only through Jesus Christ. We thank you so much for the hope that He brings to us. May we understand and live that hope. And we ask this in His name. Amen. Okay, good question. The order is not an order of importance. It's definitely not an order of where we often go chronologically in our development. It is an attempt to speak to what issues are the most foundational, perhaps. And maybe we could agree or disagree on whether the question, is there a God, comes before everything else. And I'm open to that idea. But it seems to me that before we can ever even talk about, is there a God, we have to agree on what we're going to accept as legitimate communication, for example. So there's some foundational work that would need to be done before we can even get to that question. Now that question does implicate the questions of philosophy, certainly. But so it's not an order of importance or chronology. In fact, we often ask some of the top questions first. But it is an effort to say what is going to come in terms of building a worldview, what's going to be a little more foundational than others. Any reaction to that? Does that make sense? Or okay. Brandon, I believe you had something. Yes. There's a break. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. When I was going to talk about truth, I wanted to set the stage. Well, I'm not going to do that. I wanted, first of all, for us to think about what are the different ways of knowing and consider that a bit. And I'm not going to do that right now. But then I wanted to look at the question. This would be question B on your outline. Can we know what is really true? Can we know? That's the question. And the authors Richard Middleton and Brian Walsh, they tell about three umpires that are comparing their day at the ballpark. And as they're reflecting back over the day's events, the one umpire says this. He says, there's balls and there's strikes, and I call them the way they are. The second umpire says, there's balls and there's strikes, and I call them the way I see them. And the third one says, there's balls and there's strikes, and they ain't nothing until I call them. Now, these three, I want to know, which of the three umpires was the Christian umpire? One of them was a Christian, one of them was a modernist, and one of them was a postmodernist. Now, let me just quickly say, a modernist is that person whose confidence is in science. Confidence in man's ability to reason and think and experiment and come to truth. He's a man that's locked solidly down in that bottom level. Okay, that's a modernist. A postmodernist is a person who, through things like Hiroshima, the Holocaust, and so on, has said, wait a minute. Science that has given us the bomb gives us no meaning, purpose, and morality to live with the bomb. And so they're saying, we want something up there, but we've given up on there being any kind of absolute basis for anything up there. And so, he says, no, there is no truth. The modernist says, oh yes, and it's the truth is in this stuff, and we can know it. The postmodernist says, no, we can't really know truth. In fact, it's questionable whether truth even exists. Okay, now let's review our umpires again and see if we can fit them in. The one umpire says, there's balls and there's strikes, and I call them the way they are. The next one says, there's balls and there's strikes, and I call them the way I see them. The third one, there's balls and there's strikes, and they ain't nothing until I call them. Is there truth? Can we know truth? Can we really, really know what's true, the way things really are? The first guy says, yes. See the Christian? No. The first guy says, I call them the way they are. You see what his confidence is? My confidence is my ability to see right. Scientific method, reason, I can get it, folks. Truth exists and I can get it. The last guy says, there's balls and there's strikes and they ain't nothing until I call them. In other words, Not only do I don't think there is such a thing as a ball and strike necessary, at least the only reality there is what we give to it. That's the only truth, what I bring to it. And it's all what you bring to it, the next person brings to it. It's all relative. The middleman's the Christian. The middleman is the umpire that says there's balls and there's strikes, and I call them the way I see them. He said, there is truth, but in my own ability to perceive truth right, there's a limitation. I need God.
For the most current Faith Builders recordings, visit ChristianLearning.org. And for more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit the DocForLearning.org.